Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. What happens in the rural Midwest matters as President-elect Donald Trump garnered electoral votes in the 2016 election, turning many Democratic strongholds in Republican favor. Political analysts were left gauging the significance of a possible shift in Midwestern voting patterns. John Lauck is founding president of the Midwest History Association. He has written about Trump and the Midwest for studies in Midwestern history. He joins us now from Sioux Falls with more. John Lauck, welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you, Lori. I'm glad to be here, and I'm sorry I got a little nasally cough going on, but it's that time of year.
It's Happy New Year for you. Welcome to January, and so you can't tell in the writing, but we'll see how you sound today. I can hear you just fine. Give me an idea of why look at Donald Trump in the Midwest in the first place. What intrigued you?
Well, first of all, I think lots of people were surprised about the election. Everyone was predicting prior to the vote that Hillary Clinton would win and would win by a large margin. And if you recall the final weeks of the campaign, there was quite a bit of discussion about Hillary Clinton extending her electoral victory by campaigning in Arizona, for example, which is a traditionally Republican state. And I think everyone was thinking they must have been very confident about winning and picking up some additional states that aren't traditionally Democratic. At the same time that Hillary Clinton was campaigning in Arizona, I remember thinking it was strange that Donald Trump was campaigning in the Twin Cities of Minnesota. I remember one morning seeing on the news that he had touched down in Minneapolis and had a rally. And I thought, that seems crazy to me. I mean, does he think he's going to flip Minnesota of all places? And, well, in the end, they knew something that we didn't. And they knew something that we weren't paying attention to. Surprisingly, I think this is the most shocking result of the night, was that Donald Trump only lost Minnesota by 1%. I mean, Minnesota is a very Democratic state. It's a it had not voted for a Republican since 1972.
And when you drove to Minnesota, I remember driving in late October, early November from Sioux Falls to Minneapolis, and all you saw on the way there were Trump signs out in along the highways and in the smaller towns. That's all you saw. And I remember wondering, does that mean anything at this point, or can you not tell anything from signage?
You know, that's very funny you mentioned that, because I drove to a conference in St. Cloud, Minnesota. I think it was early October, and I drove north through South Dakota up to Summit, and then I cut over on the two-laners into St. Cloud. So this would be rural Western Minnesota, central Western Minnesota. And I saw the exact same thing. I saw a lot of Trump signs and I saw zero Clinton signs. And I thought, oh, this is Minnesota. Clinton will win by 25 points here. And I was shocked at the result. But of course, the results in other states in the Midwest were also very shocking. As shocking as Minnesota, but in neighboring Wisconsin, Trump won. And he flipped a ton of counties that had previously voted for President Obama, not once, but twice. And Wisconsin had not voted for the Republican nominee for president since 1984. And even 1984 is a bit of an outlier, because 1984 was this massive Reagan landslide where he won 49 states. So it wasn't shocking that he won Wisconsin that year, too. So all of that caused me to think more about what was going on in the Midwest and why did it change this cycle.
And in this paper you wrote, you kind of go back to the origins of the GOP. Tell us a little bit about some of the roots, where this might have originally taken root.
Well, back in the early 19th century, the political contests in this country were between the Democrats, what we now call the Democrats, and the Whigs. And in the late 1940s, or excuse me, the late 1840s and the early 1850s, the Whig Party imploded. And Rising from the Ashes was a brand new party started in well, there's some debate about this, but most people say it started in Ripon, Wisconsin. That's why we have the Ripon Society today, which is still active in Washington, D.C. But in 1854, it got rolling, and it started organizing not only in Wisconsin, but in Iowa and Michigan. And it was sparked by the passage of the Kansas-Nebraska Act, in which people thought that slavery would be spread west into the new territories in places like Kansas and Nebraska. And that caused this new party to emerge very rapidly, the Republican Party. And it first elected its first president in 1860 in Abraham Lincoln. And it became the dominant party in the Midwest. And the Midwest was associated with the GOP for many, many decades until things got scrambled around a little bit during the New Deal and the crisis of the Great Depression. And ever since then, the Midwest had been something of a swing region, or some of the key states in the Midwest had been swing states like Ohio and Iowa, et cetera. But in recent decades, a number of these Midwestern states had been seen as solidly blue or part of the Democratic coalition, like Wisconsin, like Michigan, and Illinois, et cetera. But all of a sudden, we broke out of that pattern. People weren't expecting it to happen. It snuck up on us, and everyone was scratching their heads on the morning after the election. But if you look down deep into the data from some of these states, it's pretty amazing how things changed. For example, in Michigan, I think Hillary Clinton ended up winning 8 counties in Michigan. I think there's 83, 84 counties in Michigan. In the end, she only won 8. So that's a massive swing from some of the earlier cycles where the Democrats had done much better and Barack Obama had done much better.
So does it swing back then fairly easily with a stronger candidate from the Democrats? Or are we looking at something that has potential to be a little more of a permanent shift?
That's the big question, and we don't know. It could swing back, but there are signs that Trump has picked up some additional voters in some of these states that are non-traditional Republican voters, and it depends on if they stick with him. And this was something that surprised a lot of observers through the primary season. Everyone was always predicting every week that, well, Trump will finally stumble. This comment will finally cost him votes. He'll finally start to lose his supporters. But it never really happened. He never really lost ground among that core constituency.
Did he have an infrastructure that really campaigned well in the rural Midwest? Or was he just an appealing candidate to people here?
Well, that's one of the other things that should be fairly concerning to Democrats, I think, is that it's not my impression that there was much of a campaign infrastructure at all. I mean, his campaign was really focused on rallies and using social media and earned media. And there was not the kind of ground game, for example, that the Bush campaign deployed in 2000 and 2004 in places like Iowa, which became sort of famous for their use of data, for example, or even more famously, the Obama campaign and their use of data. There was nothing like that on the Trump side. So, and you can usually count on a strong ground game giving you an additional 3 to 5 points in a close race. And so the fact that Trump didn't even have that advantage, I think, should be alarming to Democrats. But I also think, looking back on it, we should have seen more signs of how weak Hillary Clinton was as a candidate in some of these states. I mean, after all, she did lose the Michigan primary to Bernie Sanders. Mm-hmm. And in places like Wisconsin, she didn't campaign in Wisconsin after June of 2016. So she, you know, we should have been paying more attention to the problems she was having. But I think we were focused on the big picture and focused on whatever Trump was saying that day, and we lost track of some of those details.
Mm. So early on in his campaign, we were trying to sort of suss out some of his policies that would affect South Dakotans. We were looking into ag policies, not finding a lot. So, and he's certainly not someone who comes from rural roots or would have a, you know, be considered someone with a prominent rural voice. What was it, if it wasn't the policies that he had laid out for farmers and producers, for example, what was he saying, do you think, that really captured the voting spirit of Midwesterners?
Well, if you look down into this data and into some of the election polls, you'll find that Donald Trump won working class white men by a 50% margin. And if you think about South Dakota, the demographics of South Dakota and who lives here and who we are as a people, as a state, we have a very large number of working class white men. And I would think farmers, farmhands, people who work on farms, people that work in small businesses, et cetera. Those would fall into that camp. And Trump did extremely well among that demographic. And if you have a state that is constituted like ours or is made up of this kind of constituency, he's going to do very well here. And he did. He won with 62% of the vote, which was higher. People forget this, but that was higher than Ronald Reagan received in 1984 in the big landslide. So he did extremely well. If you think about the various elements of the famous Obama coalition that put him in the office in 08 and 12, you know, a lot of those constituencies aren't very large in South Dakota. So right. Trump was bound to do well here.
So you mentioned in the paper sort of the masculine ideals, in quotation, those are your words, of from the era of industrialism and working class men. Does that mean gender played a role here? Is this sexism in voting?
Well, what I was talking about there is the role of the old Midwestern working class that we typically associate with Michigan and Detroit and Flint and Pontiac and a lot of those old industrial plants, where those working class voters after the New Deal, you know, into the 1940s or so, you know, 75% of those voters supported Democrats. But since that period of time, that slowly eroded down to the point where Reagan famously won those old Democratic working class voters, and they became known as Reagan Democrats. Hmm. And the famous bellwether for these voters was Macomb County, Michigan. This is just north of Detroit. It's kind of a small, modest suburban area where a lot of people who worked for General Motors and Ford, et cetera, would live. And this was a county, a swing county in Michigan. This is a way of telling which way the political winds are blowing. This was a county that Barack Obama won twice in 08 and 2012. But that county, Macomb County, full of working class white voters from the Midwest, flipped to Trump in 2016. So again, that's another good bellwether of where this group of voters was going.
So what do politicians have to do, policymakers, leaders, even the media, you mentioned in your work here, what do they have to do to speak rural American? What kind of things do they have to talk about? Because that's kind of what you're saying, too, is there's a cultural divide between the urban, the urban voters and the rural voters.
There is, and I would point people to this very interesting book that just came out by Kathy Kramer. She's a political scientist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. In the last 10 years, she's been going out into rural Wisconsin and interviewing rural Wisconsin folks about what they care about, what they're concerned about, and how they feel they're treated by the political system and the media. And this is every academic's dream, of course. Kathy's book came out about a month before the election, and the results of the election spoke to exactly what she was talking about. And she talked to these, and I encourage everyone to read it, and she talks to these rural Wisconsinites who say, you know, they're tired of being dictated to by Madison, Wisconsin, and by Milwaukee. It seems like Milwaukee gets all the attention, and that kind of drives the train in Wisconsin. And, you know, she got down to that level of granular detail where you can really see what's happening in some of these rural counties. I also saw over the weekend, I thought this was interesting. I like this this chef, Anthony Bourdain, who has this cooking show, or he doesn't really cook as much as he goes out and eats a lot, but he, I really enjoy it. And he made a comment. He said, you know, we really did blow this election, speaking as kind of a cultural elite or someone who moves in those circles. He said, you know, you can't continue to ignore people and what might be called, or what some people call, flyover country, and expect them to just come out and vote for you every single time. And he makes the point that Clinton sort of fell into that coastal trap where she spent too much time in New York and in Brooklyn, where her campaign was based, and in California raising money. And he thinks that that contributed to the erosion of her support in places like rural Michigan and rural Wisconsin.
John, we're going to have to let you go. Tell me the Kathy Kramer book. What's the title of that? Do you have it on top of your head?
Kathy Kramer's book is entitled The Politics of Resentment. It's published by the University of Chicago Press. Kathy is a professor at University of Wisconsin-Madison.
And John Lauck is founding president of the Midwestern History Association. You can read more in the January issue of Studies in Midwestern History. John, thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Lori.
Coming up after the break, we've got Hugh Weber in the studio with us. You're listening to In the Moment, SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. And this morning, SDPB contributor Hugh Weber introduces us to Justin Smith, a neuroscientist and big data analyst who shares his expertise on the brain and provides interesting insight into what that can tell us about our communities. Welcome back, Hugh.
Well, thanks, Lori. It's great to be on In the Moment. So we're deep in the work of building the podcast that will launch later this month. Last week, we teased a segment about useless and unnecessary knowledge. This week, we're going to give a little glimpse of a future episode on the human need for community and connection. I've been obsessed with this topic of what it is to be human and how that relates to how we relate with others and with ourselves on some level.
You've built a life and a career out of that topic.
I think that's a fact. Yeah. I sat down with this fantastic guy, full of energy, full of passion. He breaks some of the myths of what a PhD or an academic looks like. His name is Justin Smith. We went deep into the similarities between connection in our brains and what those networks of neurons look like, and connections that exist between individuals and communities. But I don't want to get ahead of ourselves. Let's let Justin introduce himself and his work.
My name is Justin Smith. I'm a PhD in neuroscience, and I'm currently working in big data analytics in healthcare.
Walk me through the research that you did and some of the practical implications of that work and research for human beings.
Yeah, absolutely. So my youngest brother is a police officer, and it's very personal to me to understand what happens in those moments of extreme stress. How are decisions made? What parts of the brain are involved? And what parts of the brain can we manipulate or modulate to then increase your decision-making ability? And then what are the components and factors that feature into that kind of process of making decisions under extreme stress? What we did is we looked at individuals that had to make a choice, had to make a decision. And what we found was about half the individuals were able to make a positive decision for themselves. The other individuals were not. And so what we found was individuals that can function under this extreme stress, that have the ability to learn, they have an extremely decreased stress response. And so when you understand how stress works and you can train in that environment, you're able to train yourself so that you can make the optimal decisions at that moment. And so for the applicability to police officers or to other human beings that are functioning in very, very high stress environments, is you have to understand that you need to train to that level so that when something like that does happen, you respond accordingly and you can fall back in your training at that point.
Something that you've talked a lot about before is the idea of context and the role that that plays in your ability to respond and the stress itself. Can you talk a little bit about context as a...
Yeah. So my idea and kind of how I define context is the moment by moment situation that you're in. So if you're sitting in your car right now and you're stopped at a stoplight, the context is you're fairly safe. You're waiting for the green light to come, but you're kind of looking around, you're listening to the radio, you're relaxed. It's go, you know, everything's smooth and fine. The context is different if you're walking into a bank and somebody who looks very nefarious walks in, you know, the kind of the hair in the back of your neck pricks up and you can start to see something's not quite right here, right? And so that changes kind of along that two spectrums that I just outlined, from the complete mundane traveling between point A and point B all the way to something very bad may occur very soon. And so understanding kind of where you are in that situation it helps you manipulate how you're able to make decisions. So if you're aware of your environment, if you're aware of your context moment to moment, you can then say, okay, something's happening that I need to get out of or make my way away from. Being able to recognize that before the event is happening is very powerful. And so it's kind of that idea of situation awareness or setting the context up so that you know what your decisions are before you have to make them.
So I love this idea, right? Yeah, it's right. Timely and relevant for all of us around the holiday season, switching where we fall in that spectrum between I'm sitting enjoying the radio in my car and I'm in a bank robbery. And some days feel more like a bank robbery than others.
I wouldn't know anything about that.
I suspect you might. But I like this idea that we can practice to avoid stress,
right?
That these environments are environments that we create. Now, we don't have control over everything, but we have a control over a lot more things than we think we might. And so everything to do with how we respond and make good decisions and stresses impact. To those that have made an exercise resolution for this holiday season, mm-hmm. We actually go on to talk in the podcast about how exercise is actually the silver bullet. If you do it willingly, if you aren't forced to exercise, if you do it willingly and you enjoy it, so picking an exercise, whether that's running or swimming or walking, exercise is actually the silver bullet to completely minimize stress and increase that ability to make quality decisions. So there's more of that, more depth about his work in the podcast.
Can I just add something about Justin, though? What I love about him already is that he has this PhD, big data analysis, and when you ask him about it, the first thing he talks about is his brother.
That's
which
right.
Goes back to your point about this connection. None of this matters if he doesn't look at a person that he knows and cares deeply about his safety and even how he feels throughout the day as he does his job. That just grabbed me right away.
Well, and the amazing thing is we spent an hour together. We'll spend many hours in the future, I'm certain. And the thing we talked about longest was the impact of his work, studying mice in a lab here at USD, getting a PhD in neuroscience, how it impacted his parenting. He's a new father, and we talked a lot about having young boys and how to manage context and stress and interest and all of those things. So it's amazing how human this very academic world is for him. But I want to jump ahead to where we talk about connection. Let's start on a really light topic. What is it about human beings that makes them prone to connection? What is it about their makeup, either the chemistry of their brain or their sociological impulses that leads them to connect?
So human beings, from my perspective, we are essentially hardwired or absolutely prone to function in groups. Groups of small groups like a nuclear family, all the way up to small cities, that have a couple hundred thousand of thousands of people. But the idea of you have to rely on other individuals to succeed is something that I think we absolutely get, which is why we're social animals, why we're social creatures, why we like to connect, why we like to create with each other, why we like to engage in activities with one another. That's something we've been doing evolutionarily for a long, long time, which is what makes us very successful.
You know, something you and I have talked a lot about are we spend a lot of time mapping networks, so visualizing relationships, and you've spent an abundant amount of time in your PhD study focused on the wiring of the brain and the responses of the brain. Where do those things intersect? Where are those ideas similar? Where are they different? What impacts or influences the other?
Yeah, I think it's a very powerful question, and it's one where you can look at it as a giant system that's all interconnected, right? And so if you kind of look at it under the microscope lens, you can see, you know, the connectivity of certain parts of the brain to each other. If you zoom in again, you can see the different parts of the neurons connecting to each other. And then you zoom in again, you can see how inside each cell there's things going on that are connected. But then you can also flip that switch and go all the way and zoom it back out and look at, you know, how communities are connected, how individuals are connected to one another, kind of those social networking maps that we've done. And what's profound to me is no matter where you are with the Zoom, looking at the system, it looks very similar. And so it's one of those powerful things for me to see that if you're looking at it on, you know, the molecular level, all the way out to how villages and small cities are connected between neighborhoods, between individuals, no matter what, it all, you can visually map it the same way.
So this human need to connect is so hardwired that the communities that we build look like maps of neurons of the brain, which is totally fascinating. I think it's particularly important to think about in the modern context of connection through technology that may or may not result in actually satisfying that need to connect. So we're going to explore much of this in the podcast. We hope that these segments, the teasers we do with you here on In the Moment and the podcast later this month can be that source of connection to each other and to the world.
You've been working hard on this podcast. A lot goes into it. What else can you, what more can I sort of ease out of you about this?
Well,
I want to know more.
Yeah, we have a name now, which is exciting. I think I have permission to share. Either way, we're going to roll with it. We wanted to capture the uniqueness of this region, but we also wanted to set a really high standard for the guests we introduce, the conversations we have, the stories that we share. We wanted there to be a place at the table for everyone, but we also wanted to create this expectation that everyone should be expected to contribute. So in a couple weeks, I'm excited to share that we'll be inviting the state of South Dakota and the world to join us at the Potluck Society.
The Potluck Society.
Yes, it's this perfect,
love it.
Perfect blend of, well, no tater tot hot dish. That's right. The only thing we won't allow, but perfect blend of hot dish and bars and great conversation with friends and family.
What more, what can we expect in the episodes?
Well, I'm so excited. I've been burning the phone lines and when I can driving up and down the interstates and two lane roads. I'm going to be talking with coffee baristas. I spoke with a guy whose profession is designing questions. I'm going to meet with my own high school debate coach, a pig farmers, a young robot builder. Generally, anyone you might meet walking down the street, they're really people like us, people like the listeners and those folks out there. Each week, I'm going to convene the Potluck Society to discuss a person, a place, or an idea. Then we're going to sit down with that person or visit that place to take a deeper look. I'm going to bring in a second voice that gives us a little different context about that issue or that situation. And then we're going to rejoin a member of that Potluck Society to talk about what we've learned and to offer a call to action. All you need to do is really follow along and contribute when it feels right. And as I have become fond of saying, most importantly, don't forget to bring an idea to pass.
Is there a place where you sign up or you can get info on the podcast as it gets ready to launch?
Yeah, in the next couple of weeks, we'll launch the podcast officially on iTunes and other places. But as of this morning, if people want to make sure they don't miss anything, if they want to be part of the ongoing conversation via email and ultimately social, they can go to the Potluck Society. .com to sign up for an email and a weekly invitation, and soon there will be all the information they could possibly want on SDPB's website as well.
And it'll be back here every Tuesday to give us an idea of what's going on.
As long as you'll have me, and I'll come bringing brownies.
Excellent. Hugh Weber, thank you so much for being with us today. We appreciate it, and we look forward to the Potluck Society.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, author John Nixon talks about the interrogation of Saddam Hussein. You're listening to In the Moment, SDPB Radio. Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. 10 years ago, on December 30th, Saddam Hussein was executed. He had been captured by American military forces after an intensive manhunt. A new book by former CIA senior analyst John Nixon opens the door to history by taking you into the room where the Iraqi dictator was interrogated. Nixon conducted the first prolonged interrogation of Hussein. His book, Debriefing the President, The Interrogation of Saddam Hussein, is in bookstores now. It strips away the mythology of the Butcher of Baghdad, leaving a revealing portrait of a complex man who believed the attacks on America on 9/11 would bring the United States and Iraq closer together. Author John Nixon joins us from Alexandria, Virginia now. John, welcome to In the Moment.
Hello, thank you for having me.
We appreciate your being here. Let's start with this notion I spent the weekend with this book, and one of the things that struck me so much was how unprepared or unorganized, if you will, the American intelligence community was to sort of capture and then deal with Saddam Hussein. Can you put that into context for us?
Sure. You know, there was this belief that somehow Saddam was going to go down with a ship. Let me preface that by saying, first of all, Washington was very, very, was breathing down our neck and telling Baghdad, we got to find him. You know, we let Osama bin Laden escape, and we can't allow Saddam Hussein to escape. And so there was a lot of pressure from Washington to find him. So, you know, we were getting all of these reports saying that Saddam was going to kill himself, that he'd take, you know, basically go down with the ship. And our own psych evaluation at the agency was that this is not going to happen. This man is a survivor. Why would he want to kill himself? And yet, no matter what we said, everybody believed that he was going to kill himself. Well, anyway, to make a long story short, he gets captured, and then he survives. He's alive. And we sent the message back to Washington, and they once we verified who he was, nobody really knew what to do.
And you're an integral part of that verification process, and then you end up being part of these conversations and calling them a debriefing instead of an interrogation, although occasionally he says, you know, you cannot interrogate him. You don't really have time on a daily basis to prepare in the way that you would like to. Why not? And what was lost in your mind because you didn't have that sort of structure or plan laid out from leadership?
Well, you know, and I'm not a professional interrogator, I'm an analyst, I'm a subject matter expert, but I've participated in a number of debriefings or interrogations, whatever you want to call them. And the thing is, when you capture somebody, there's something called, you know, the rush of capture, which is when people feel that they feel vulnerable and they feel unsure of themselves, and if you start questioning them right away, it's the shock of capture, that is. You can sometimes extract information that once they've calmed down and once they've kind of gotten their bearings straight, is a little more difficult to get at. And in Saddam's case, he had a whole week to kind of get his bearings straight. And I sometimes wish we would have had a little bit more time right in the beginning, because even he was wondering why nobody was coming out to talk to him. And it's largely because Washington was still trying to figure out what it was going to do now that they had him in their hands, and he was alive.
There are some thoughts that there should be some more coercive tactics used against him. You disagree with that. How come? Why doesn't the coercion that some people were suggesting, stripping him down and soaking him in cold water, for example, why does that not work in your mind, or why is that not effective?
Well, you know, something. He didn't have any. It was completely inappropriate because the kind of information that we were looking for him was not something relatable to immediate threat information. This was about the nature of his regime and, in particular, his weapons of mass destruction program. This was the question that Washington really wanted to know more than anything else, and it's something that we got at, and certainly when we found out, when we got our answer, it was something that Washington really didn't want to hear.
And the answer was, well, we all know through history. Yeah, go ahead.
The answer was that there were no weapons of mass destruction, and that he didn't intend to reconstitute his program.
Right.
Now, years later, the FBI said that he did plan to reconstitute his program in an interview with a special agent on 60 Minutes, and that I completely disagree with that statement. I don't think the man was qualified to be making the statement, and there is no evidence to suggest that that is the case.
Did he have an awareness of how important that notion was to America at that time?
No, of course. Yeah. Of course. And he looked at us with kind of like with scorn. Like, why do you think I've done this? Why, you know, and Saddam was kind of his own worst enemy at times because he really didn't understand America, and he didn't understand why we didn't understand him. Mm. And, you know, there was really this blame on both sides here, you know, in terms of both sides And it's largely due to the fact that we have no diplomatic relations with Iraq. We had no embassy. We had no way of communicating with him except through third parties. And, you know, what, it's bound to happen, if that's the case, that you're going to have miscommunications and misperceptions.
What did we get wrong with him as a person, as a man? What did we fundamentally not understand about him that helped create the sort of caricature that we think of Saddam Hussein now?
Okay. Well, one of the things that we really got wrong was just, you know, Saddam was not this master manipulator, not the, this man who's pulling a million strings and is responding and acting as his own agent and setting all of these things in motion, especially in the last few years of his regime. In the last few years of his regime, he was very disengaged from governing on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, meanwhile, the Bush administration has him basically, has depicted him as somebody who's going to blow up the world with his nuclear weapons.
And he's sending out a novel instead.
I'm sorry?
He's sending out a novel instead. When you say disengaged, I mean, he's actually trying to write books.
Yeah, you know, he was an elderly man who was getting on in years, and you know he was kind of pursuing interests that he always had, but never felt he could, and now felt he could probably at the worst time in his life, because after 9/11, Saddam didn't understand this, but after 9/11 the rules changed, and you know the United States was no longer going to tolerate him in any way, shape, or form. So it's almost irrelevant if we found WMD or not. I mean, the Bush administration was coming for him no matter what.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John Nixon. He's an author, a former CIA senior analyst. The book is called Debriefing the President, The Interrogation of Saddam Hussein. And John, one of the things that also struck me as I was reading this is that you, as you're the one who's bringing us into the room with you, you never forget not only the loss of American lives, but you never forget who he tortured or what he is capable of, but yet you also see him as a human being. We talked a little bit about writing, and just his sense of humor is in there too, which can be sort of, off-putting in some way. Tell me a little bit about who he was as a person in conversation. What was he like to have a conversation with?
You know, he was incredibly charismatic. Huh. When he walked into a room, the room felt like it changed. And I can just imagine what it must have, and this was in his diminished circumstances, I can imagine what it must have been like when he was had the full entourage and the guards and the Armani suits and what have you. You know, he could be incredibly charming and funny, and you know, witty, and just a great person to talk to. But, you know, the more you got to know him, the more you began to see this other side, which was kind of a darker, more imperious side, and he could be really arrogant and nasty and kind of mean-spirited and vicious. And the more you got to know him, the less you wanted to be around him.
Right. His childhood, how did that sort of impact the person that he, the leader that he grew up to be?
I'm sorry, can you say that question one more time?
His childhood, I'm wondering about. He grew up in poverty, right? How did that impact him as a world leader then?
Yeah, yes. He lacked a really, to be honest, he lacked a formal education. And he understood, he grew up also in the politics of conspiratorial Iraqi politics. And that served him well for gaining power. But when it came to understanding, you know, how to interact with other nations, and certainly how international relations with great powers were conducted, it was clear that he was a man out of his depth.
He has a sense that he is not going to be long for this world. Did you get the feeling that he had an eye to his own legacy and how he wanted to be remembered, or was he not really thinking in those terms?
Oh, no, I think he was obsessed with his role in Iraqi history, and certainly when trying to get him to talk, and initially when we were meeting with him to see if he would participate in these debriefings, that was the angle that we played with him. But even before that, I mean, Saddam spent a great deal of time commemorating his rule in Iraq, as evidenced by the murals and the statues and everything that was around the city. By the time I got there in October 2003, many of these things were taken down, but there were still a few left. And I remember asking him, it was a question that I always wanted to ask. Ever since his fall, I always wanted to ask him. And I said, you know, how does it feel now that these are all taken down? And he had, you know, he gave me this response of like, I never asked anybody to put up a statue of me. It was the command's decision, and who am I to overrule the command?
Hmm. Did you believe that assessment?
Oh, of course not.
Right.
No. of course it was his decision.
There's not a moment where...
I will say, in theory, what he's saying is true, but the command was his to command, and they all knew what he wanted, and so they gave him what he wanted, and, you know, so.
And this notion of sort of, you know, saying it's the commander's fault goes back to some of the human rights violations, the use of chemical weapons on Kurds. He says in the end that wasn't his choice either.
Yes, that was one. That was really, really something that, because I didn't believe him when he first told me.
Right.
And then it was only later on that I discovered that actually he was telling the truth. He did not give the command to use chemical weapons. In fact, that was a battlefield decision made by one of his generals. And actually, Saddam was quite upset with that decision, because it was done in the Iranian portion of Kurdistan, and he was afraid that Iran would use this to discredit Iraq in the international media.
But he had given his commanders the permission to make that kind of command-level decision?
He did give permission to his commanders. Right. So, yeah. I mean, he's not without blame, but certainly it highlights this issue of complexity that... Mm. Sometimes we look at these people and we see them as black and white, when in fact sometimes they're gray, and sometimes the things that happen aren't as clear cut in our minds as they are in reality.
Who did he admire in the world? Who did he sort of, did he pattern his leadership after anyone else?
You know, he told us, you know, people like Lenin and Mao and George Washington and de Gaulle. And, you know, he never picked out any Arab leaders, though. He didn't admire any Arab leaders because he saw them all as rivals, which I thought was very interesting. One of the things that we always heard about was that he patterned his leadership style on Stalin and Hitler, which was, according to Saddam, and I believe him, was not true. And I always heard about how he had this library of thousands of books on Stalin and Hitler that he had studied, which, of course, was not true either.
Hmm. So why is that significant, that Hitler and Stalin are not in his, you know, in his lexicon in that way? Why does that matter for American policy against him?
Because, you know, something, ever since George Herbert Walker Bush in the first Gulf War started calling him, saying he was like Hitler, you know, we have this problem in American foreign policy where we come up against somebody that we don't like, then they do something that we really don't like, and then we start calling them Hitler. Mm. And then all of a sudden they take on the qualities of Hitler. And you know something, make ourselves sound strong by saying this man's Hitler and they've got to go, but we don't realize that once we do that, we limit our options, because really who can negotiate with a Hitler? Who wants to talk to Hitler? Nobody. Mm. And it's a self-defeating thing. And you know, as far as what these people would say about his love of Hitler and Stalin, it was just another way to discredit Saddam.
Hmm. How rare is this kind of interrogation or debriefing, or however, whatever word we want to use? How often does this sort of thing happen? This is a pretty monumental moment in history, truthfully.
Yes, it doesn't. You know, with a world leader, it doesn't happen very. It doesn't happen frequently. I can say that much. I think the last time this probably happened was when Noriega was captured in 1989. But as far as, you know, debriefing efforts go in Iraq, I mean, there was a great deal of debriefing efforts being done. We can call it debriefing interrogation when it came to, you know, the Shia insurgency and the Sunni insurgency. So, you know, it's an important element in fighting the war, because there's a lot of intelligence that can be gleaned from these individuals that come off the battlefield. And, you know, you don't have to torture them, I don't think. In fact, I think you're much better off not torturing them and using, you know, other methods that can get you information that is more reliable and more actionable.
So I want to know what this experience was like for you. What was it sort of like to go in there every day and go out every night and get ready for the next day?
Well, it was fascinating. It was exhausting. Mm-hmm. I really loved it. But near the end, I remember my last day with Saddam, I remember waking up and saying to myself, oh my gosh, I don't even want to talk to this guy anymore. He's just so nasty, you know? But you know, I went in and did it, and, I knew while I was doing it that this was a very unique thing and that not every analyst got to do this sort of work, and I was very thankful for that.
There's a personal cost to you as well, I'm sure, not only in physical health, but you had your mother passed away while you were in Iraq also, but her wishes were that you finished that work.
I'm sorry?
You talked to her before you left, and she wanted you to finish that work and
She said not to worry about her, that she'd be fine, and that, you know, wherever I was, if you know, that I should continue what I was doing if anything happened to her. And you know, it was tough going, believe me. It was not pleasant being so far away that I couldn't get back in time. But you know, that's why one of the many reasons why I dedicate the book to my mother and my father, because without them, you know, none of this would have happened.
And you know, we're sorry for that loss. And then I'm also should mention that, you know, the CIA itself comes off in this book is there's certainly some procedural problems. Some, you know, you brief George W. Bush, and there's quite a story there that I would direct the readers to sort of see. What is it like to see an agency that you love so much struggle internally and then on the national political scene as well? We just have about a minute left. We'll just kind of close with that, John.
Okay. I'm sorry. It's hard to make out what you're saying. Can you just say that question one more time?
We just have about a minute left, so... let me just go ahead and say thank you, and we really appreciate your time. It's a fascinating book. It's called Debriefing the President, The Interrogation of Saddam Hussein. My guest has been John Nixon. He's a former CIA senior analyst. John, we appreciate your time. Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me.
All right. Bye now. And coming up in our second hour, we'll have U.S. Senator Mike Rounds with us. If you have a question for Senator Rounds or other thoughts and ideas, we would like to hear from you. Send us an email now in the moment at sdpb.org, or you can text us 605-956-7372, 956-SDPB. So Mike Rounds is up next. We also have Lee Strubinger, SDPB's political reporter. He'll come. He's talked to Secretary of State Chantel Krebs about the need for an ethics commission in South Dakota. We'll hear from him as well. And then near the end of next hour, we'll have a conversation with John Pelletier. We talked to him yesterday. He's going to talk more about things you can do to kick the new year off right with your personal finances. So again, send us an email if you have a question for U.S. Senator Mike Rounds. It's in the moment at sdpb.org. Send us a text 605-956-7372, 956-SDPB. We'll be back after the news.